words. Mostly, you'll need to show, not tell, your coworkers that change is possible. That is, prove it to them with action. That usually means starting with small actions and issues at first, things you can win with the people you have so far, taking just a small step out of their comfort zone, farther each time. When it works, more people will be drawn in, and as they participate, their confidence will grow. Hopelessness can be a strong habit. It's easier to break a habit with group support. Bringing people together can help individuals get past their discouragement. No one's willing to do anything. Have you asked them personally to do something specific? Most of us aren't natural-born organizers. Many of your coworkers won't initiate activity, but they will respond if asked directly by someone they trust. Figure out some very small, specific requests and personally approach a coworker. At first, it might be as simple as answering a survey, coming to lunch with other workers to discuss a problem, or signing a group letter. But be respectful of time constraints in their lives and show lots of appreciation for anything they're willing to do. This attitude of respect will make them comfortable doing more in the future. No one comes to meetings. Think about how people are notified about meetings. An email or a notice on the bulletin board isn't a good method. Personal, face-to-face invitations are the very best. Divide up your workplace. Find several other people to share the work of inviting people individually. Also, consider the practical things that could make meetings more accessible. Scheduling, location, childcare, language. And when people do come to meetings, the meeting had better be pleasant and productive, or they probably won't be back. People are incredibly busy these days, and you will convey respect for their participation by planning a meeting ahead of time. Prepare a clear agenda, a time frame for the meeting, and a reason to attend, such as a hot issue. Most importantly, be patient and don't give up. Organizing is a marathon, not a sprint. That was from an article by an article called Beating Apathy in the November 2015 issue of Labor Notes. That wraps it up for Labor Radio this Monday and every Monday from 6 to 6:30 on KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, the only show of its type in Oregon or Southwest Washington, of the working class, for the working class, by the working class. Thanks to our engineer, Danielle Parks. This is Jamie Partridge. Stay tuned for Prison Pipeline.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening, and the time is 6:32, and you are listening to KBOO Portland. Up next is Prison Pipeline, followed by Hard Knocked Radio at 7.
KBOO Community Radio currently has a one-to-one match for all new and increasing members. A $100 new or increased donation will become $200 to support the important work of KBOO.
If you become a member at this time or increase your donation over last year, your donation will be matched one-to-one by a group of generous donors up to $10,000. Consider becoming a monthly sustaining member. This can be set up easily and securely online. Over 70% of KBOO's income is from you, our listeners, who take action to become KBOO members.
Go to kboo.fm/support to have your donation matched today, or mail your donation to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214. Thank you for supporting KBOO.
Okay! to semi-conscious b-boy, third day of Kwanzaa, Ujima. Collective works and responsibilities to make our brothers and sisters' problems our problems and to solve them together. So what we do is we light that second red candle and pray for a way to make sure we're better stewards of our family, to help each other without hurting ourselves in the process. Know what I mean? So as you get together and help each other, make sure your children see you so they have a model of people supporting and blessing each other. Know what I mean? And after that, happy Kwanzaa.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 33rd Real Music Film Festival running from January 15th through February 8th. Real Music explores the lively interplay between sound and image, music and culture. Opening night, January 15th, will be Roxy the Movie, directed by Frank Zappa. Filmed over three nights in December 1973 at the Roxy Theater in Hollywood, Roxy the Movie encapsulates the qualities that made Frank Zappa a revolutionary musical pioneer. That's January 15th at 9:15 p.m. at the Northwest Film Center in the Witzel Auditorium at 1219 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information on the films and more can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
Good evening. This is Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. I'm Amy Johnson. Tonight I'll be airing audio from a performance that took place on October 18th, 2015, at the First Unitarian Church in downtown Portland. The performance was called With You on the Journey. It was the culmination of a series of writing workshops for family members of people in prison. The performance included 10 family members and 11 monologues, which told the stories of having a loved one in prison. Tonight is part two and includes the third and fourth monologues. The performance will be aired in segments over the next few months, and the next one will air on January 11th, 2016. We begin with Chris Karsmar introducing tonight's monologues.
Our next two readers, Marilyn and Carol, are mothers of young sons, and as you'll see, in some ways they tell similar stories.
My diamond in the rough. My 17-year-old son was arrested again last April. He's now in custody of the Oregon Youth Authority, or OYA, until he is 25 years old. Or gets off of probation. My husband and I are relieved he's off the street. But we're also getting more scared because in Oregon Youth Authority, he is getting even more indoctrinated into the gangs. Gangs have inundated OYA and overwhelm its ability to help kids. I did not expect to be so utterly disregarded as a force in my son's life when he entered this system. I feel that we are the best hope for him leaving the gang. OYA's culture of corrections sidelines parents and weakens family bonds. In the many interactions that I have had with OYA, I have never been asked one question about my son. Other than visits, we are only entitled to one 90-minute meeting every 3 months to review his progress. But we have no spot on the agenda as his parents. We're not informed about fights that he might have been in. We're not informed when they change his medication. It's as if we know nothing about this person and have nothing to bring to the table. I'm confused when they tell me that I am an involved parent. As parents, we are now in a very dark and deceptive maze. And I fear that we are losing a battle for my son's soul. Our son grew up in Lake Oswego. We were a healthy, intact family. He has an older brother and a twin brother. They had their typical adolescent challenges, but nothing remotely like what our other son has experienced. During childhood, our son was high-strung, kind of anxious, but also a good student and a talented writer, and he socialized well with peers. But in seventh grade, he became infatuated with the TV show Gangland. By ninth grade, he had spun out of control and was diagnosed with something called oppositional defiant disorder, in addition to his anxiety. We were told by doctors that it would take years, not months, to turn him around. So we pleaded with the Department of Human Services for a year-long placement or more in some therapeutic setting. But our pleas went ignored, despite recommendations from psychiatrists. Instead, his issues simply worsened. And as a result, he has now lived in 14 different facilities in the last 3 years. This would be a challenge for anybody, especially a teen with anxiety issues. It was in the first of one of these group homes where he was recruited into the Sereños gang. He was the only child in this home who was not in the gang, so he probably joined to meet his needs of belonging, protection, and excitement. At each placement he has been to, he simply meets more gang-involved kids. Now, his need for belonging is met by the gang instead of by us, his actual family. When I asked him why he likes the gang, sometimes he says he doesn't feel like he really fits into our family anymore. We realize now that being in a gang is like being in a cult, only there's no deprogrammers for gangs. Instead, gang members are incarcerated with other gang members. At first, we were so naive. We didn't know for a long time that those three little blue dots on his hand that he tattooed himself while in Donald D. Long detention were actually a gang symbol. And I happily bought him a lot of blue clothes one summer, thinking that he looked so good in blue. It matched his eyes. Then when school started, the school resource officer informed me that all those blue clothes that he had, those were his gang clothes. We just could not wrap our mind around how someone with his background, with two parents, college educated, living in Lake Oswego, would join a gang in East Gresham. As his crimes became more serious, Oregon Youth Authority was given full custody in 2014. We have followed him from placement to placement, regardless of the mileage, and visited weekly. Our families improved last year when he was placed in an alcohol treatment program, his second one, and we were allowed to have family therapy. During that therapy, our family relations improved, and things went fairly well, as long as we avoided discussing his gang affiliation. That program was not equipped to deal with gang issues. It was an alcohol and drug program, strictly. He did not deal with his gang issues that year because he didn't have to. OYA completely let him sidestep that issue at a time when he was probably the most motivated. We knew he wasn't done with the gang, and we asked to have his probation extended for 3 months after he was released from that program. Although we continued to be apprehensive, we were also hopeful. He graduated from that program in time to be home for Christmas for the first time in 2 years. Things were really looking up. I was laughing and enjoying myself, finally, because my family was whole again. In winter quarter, he did quite well at the Gateway to College program at Portland Community College. He was only one credit away from high school graduation a year early. In that program, he wrote a paper about his experiences with the justice system that were so compelling it brought tears to his teacher's eyes. Last spring, he was finally off probation, but only 10 days later, he hooked up with his gang buddies on a nice Saturday afternoon and was arrested again. This time, his crime was much more serious and came within a hair's breadth of costing a life. We felt that he had chosen the gang over our family. We were devastated and grief-stricken. His gang involvement was a slap in the face of our family and everything we stand for. I feel broken as a mother, angry as a parent, and ashamed as a member of society. My work as a special ed teacher suffered, which contributed to my retirement at the end of the last school year. Recently, on a visit at his current facility, I was shocked to see my son wearing a rosary around his neck. That is a well-known gang symbol. I complained to the state, but the state has taken a path of least resistance to avoid a lawsuit. My involvement was not welcome. When a new person joins his facility, there are frequently fights. Clearly, the state is not able to prevent these fights. So what does a child in one of these facilities do for protection? Unlike when he was living at home, when he is in OYA, he has to be in a gang in order to survive. How can any of this be helpful? With one full-time psychologist for the entire state of OYA, and one counselor at his facility of 50 kids, I am going to have to lower my expectations that they are going to provide any help to him and his inner demons. I will have to learn to let go. In this system, my husband and I are simply bystanders instead of parents, even though, again, we are his greatest hope. He finally has that long-term placement we asked for, but the price, he is immersed with the gang culture while he is supposed to be getting out of the gang. OYA is turning out to be its own nightmare. Even though one of the rehabilitation classes he will be getting is a gang intervention program, it may be too little, too late. In fact, very few kids leave the gang while in OYA. I can't help but wonder, if he had had that long-term program 3 years ago when we asked for it, would we be in a different place today? Adrian, a wise woman from this group whose son was also in OYA, said that our job is to love our children unconditionally while they learn from their mistakes. Right now, I hope And I pray that with enough time and enough pressure, my son will transform, just like coal turns to a diamond. Perhaps one day he will be a stronger and clearer person. For now, my son is still my diamond, very much in the rough. Thank you.
I was the one enabling, codependent. I can't tell you how many times during the 10 years of my son David's addiction, I was accused of being enabling and codependent by all the experts who I desperately hoped could help him. I came to resent the whole pack of them, the outpatient counselors, the inpatient counselors, the intake counselors, the residential treatment counselors, the recovery coaches, the psychologists, the psychiatrists, the public defenders, the district attorneys, especially the district attorneys, the police, the probation officers, the judges, and even the other parents of using children who should have known better. At my most resentful, I felt that they had all drunk the same addiction treatment Kool-Aid, had all become true believers in the gospel of hitting bottom as the only way an addict would stop using. Wanting to point a finger somewhere, they always pointed it at who else? The mom, who by refusing to throw her son out of the house was actually his worst enemy, preventing him from hitting bottom. I felt that it was too easy to come to those conclusions about me, and that I was the one who had been on the front lines with David, living through all the difficulties of his childhood and adolescence, as well as the day-to-day horrors of his addiction. I was the one who had been trying to make things better for him since, as soon as he started school, he had been labeled with attention deficit disorder. I was the one who had witnessed his pain as he struggled with schoolwork, was treated as a pariah by his classmates, and so gravitated to other marginalized kids for friendship. I was the one who had suffered through all those conferences with exasperated teachers and, not wanting to pour drugs down my child's throat, tried to help him in every way I could, short of medicating him. I was the one who felt pained and confused when none of that worked. I was the one who'd agonized about divorcing his father when David was six. I went ahead with it only when it became clear to me that, painful as the divorce would be, given the damage his father had already done to David, it would be worse for David if I did not go through with it. And I was the one who witnessed David's despair when, after the divorce, his father absented himself from David's life. I was the one who became a single parent, trying to support us both and nurture David as best I could. I was the one who got the call from his high school when David was 15, telling me that he'd been arrested along with some other kids for smoking marijuana in an abandoned building near the school during lunch hour. And so the criminal justice system entered our lives. I was the one who brought David's school assignments and contact lens fluid to the jail neither of which they gave him, so that not only did he not pass his courses that term, but could hardly see the whole time he was there. I was the one who, on a visit to David at the jail, saw a guard push another boy up against a wall and make him shout over and over again, "Sorry, Mom, I like to steal. Sorry, Mom, I like to steal." When I called the warden about this, I was told that it had never happened. After David got out of jail, I was the one, sick with worry, when a week later at a bowling alley, he was taken into custody by his probation officer from hell and charged with 5 things he hadn't done. The probation officer refused for the next 2 months to talk to me. The judge ignored the letter I sent. The public defender had no help to offer at all. And David and I were terrified the whole time of what would happen if he was found guilty of these charges. When we got to court, the probation officer immediately motioned to have all of the charges dismissed. So, why had she brought them in the first place? Was it a sadistic game? After that, because David was now taking Adderall, a medication for ADD, the probation officer accused him of using meth, which, like Adderall, is an amphetamine. She wouldn't believe me when I told her it was Adderall, and the only way I could prove it was by having the lab, which had done the test, confirm what I was saying. So I made what seemed like 100 phone calls and finally got the proof I needed. Then in the hearing, the probation officer told the judge that she might file a motion to have David removed from my custody because I'd been a pest, repeatedly calling her to get this straightened out. Of course, she didn't tell the judge that she never returned my calls. I was the one. I was the one. I was the one. I was the one who was so relieved when David got into drug court and had the opportunity to get his felony wiped off the books, and then felt so miserable when a year later, on the brink of graduating from drug court, he got caught using again and was sent to jail with a felony to keep him company. I was the one whose wallet he dipped into over and over as he got deeper into using, so that I hid it as soon as I got home, and then sometimes could not remember where, or left the house without it, only remembering with a cart full of groceries at the checkout counter that I had no way of paying for them. I was the one who got him into one treatment program after another. No easy task. And then had to persuade him to go. A much harder task. I was the one who watched him begin using again soon after leaving those programs. I was the one who, after he started using meth, held him when he sobbed with horror because he could not stop, watched him unable to sleep or eat for days at a time. I was the one who listened to him high as a kite, talking gibberish, or peeking out the windows deep in paranoia, hallucinating police in a squad car in front of the house. I was the one who took him more than once to the emergency room, terrified that he was overdosing. And like David, I stopped sleeping. So, How was it that all of those experts, all of those professionals had no compassion for me and no interest in my thoughts about who David was and what he needed? Why were they so sure they knew what was best for him and that I was of no use? Why did they expect me to demonstrate passionate comparing for David, but never let him violate my boundaries? Why did they expect that kind of perfection from a worn-down single mom who had never had an addicted child and was alone with it? And how could I trust their judgment if they were treating me that way? Maybe they were right about his needing to hit bottom, but all I knew was that he had nobody but me, and I could not abandon him just to please them. Toward the end of his using, we made an expensive trip to Portland from our house in Klamath Falls. Once again, by jumping through a lot of hoops and swallowing what I really wanted to say to a hostile and disapproving intake counselor, I'd managed to get David admitted into a treatment program. But when we got to Portland, after 6 hours on the train, they drug tested him and found that he still had benzos in his system. This was a surprise to him, because he hadn't realized how long they would linger. So, although I was out of work and I'd had to pay for round-trip train tickets, 2 nights at a hotel, and food, we had no choice but to go home. The one good thing which came out of that trip was a book I found at Powell's called Beautiful Boy, My Journey.